has to be even more immaculate than its usual immaculate self. When he gets to the housekeeping office, he sees an unfamiliar older woman in uniform, khakis and hydrangea blue polo shirt, running through the 100-point checklist with Ms. English. This woman has bright red hair that looks spun over her scalp like cotton candy. Her face is plump and wrinkled and kind-seeming. She must be a reinforcement for Mr. Darling's visit. "Chadwick," Ms. English says, "please meet Doris Mulvaney, your new cleaning partner." "My, you'll be showing Doris the ropes today. I told her you were one of our best cleaners." One of the best on a staff of four isn't much of an accomplishment, but Chad feels a swell of pride nonetheless. He offers Doris a hand. "Pleasure to meet you, Ms. Mulvaney." She giggles and her blue eyes twinkle. "Call me Doris, please, lad." She has an Irish accent, which is cool, Chad thinks. Chad looks at Ms. English. "Where's Bibi?" "You and Doris will start with third floor checkouts. We need to get the entire third floor cleaned before Mr. Darling arrives." "No problem, but thank you, Chadwick. If you stop by here at the end of the day, we can chat then. But not now. We have too much work in front of us." Chad and Doris take the service elevator to the third floor. "How old are you, lad?" Doris asks.
22, he says flatly.
Bibi was fired, he thinks. Ms. English gave her the axe. But she didn't steal the Gucci belt. That was a ruse cooked up by the fake Shelley Carpenter. Bibi probably didn't take Mrs. Daly's Fendi scarf either. Mrs. Daly must have left it at Ventuno.
"In university?" Doris asks.
"I graduated in May," he says, "from Bucknell University in central Pennsylvania."
"And now you're working here?"
"Uh-huh," Chad says.
He wants to be polite, but he also doesn't want to encourage chatting.
"My parents have a home here, and this is my summer job."
He wonders if maybe something else is going on. Maybe Bibi's daughter, Smokey, was diagnosed with some kind of awful cancer, or maybe there was a domestic issue with the baby daddy, Johnny Quarter. Maybe Bibi and Smokey got in the car and went looking for Johnny Quarter, or maybe Octavia and Paz were mean to Bibi on the ferry and that made her quit.
"My son is the plumber for the hotel," Doris says, "and when I heard you were short-handed in the housekeeping department, I offered to jump in and help. I cleaned rooms at the Balsams Resort in Colebrook, New Hampshire for years, and at Ballyseed Castle back in Ireland when I was your age." She pats his arm, "so I know what I'm doing."
"When did you hear we were short-handed?" Chad asks.
Doris shrugs.
"Top of last week, I believe."
Top of last week? But Bibi has been at work every day. Just yesterday, she informed Chad that they were tripling the floral arrangements in every suite because of Xavier Darling's arrival. There would be bouquets in the living room and both bedrooms. Chad and Bibi had groaned about this together, triple the lily stamens to trim, triple the hydrangea dust. But there had been no indication that Bibi wouldn't be around to pluck the wilting snapdragon blossoms. When they'd parted ways the day before, Bibi had slung her backpack over her shoulder and said, "See ya, Longshot," just like usual. He wants to text and ask her what happened. Is she okay? But Chad doesn't have Bibi's number. There were times when he'd wanted to ask for it, but he'd always stopped himself because... why? He obviously thought about Bibi when he wasn't at work, never in a sexual way, just in a friendship way. There were TikToks he'd wanted to send her and news bulletins about fin sightings on the South Shore. Bibi was a devoted fan of Shark Week. Stuff they could talk about the next day at work. But he never wanted to seem weird or eager, and he certainly didn't want to give her the wrong idea. Now, however, he has no way to reach her. Chad knows Xavier Darling is supposed to arrive between 2 and 3 p.m., but at that hour, Chad and Doris are cleaning room 111 on the pool side of the hotel, so he can't watch for him out the window. Doris is a brisk and efficient cleaner, and she doesn't mind tackling the bathrooms. "The loo," she says, "is my particular specialty." Chad is then left to handle Bibi's particular specialty, which is the bed. It has been weeks, maybe even months, since Chad was charged with making a bed, but he does a textbook, if robotic, job.
His mind is elsewhere. On Bibi, of course, but also on Xavier Darling's arrival. Chad expects to feel a shift in the hotel, a crackle in the air, a rumbling of the floors, alarms ringing, or an alert on his phone. Out the window, Chad hears only children laughing and splashing in the family pool. At 4:15, he and Doris move down to room 108, which has a fine view of Easton Street, but the street is quiet. At 5:00, Chad and Doris finish their last room of the day, and Chad rolls the cleaning cart to the storage closet and restocks it for tomorrow. $120 have been left as tips, and he and Doris split the money. He tries not to seem like he's rushing, though he is a bit, and he says to Doris, "Nice meeting you, see you tomorrow," in a falsely cheerful voice before he hightails it to the housekeeping office. But Ms. English isn't there. Chad can't believe it. It's 5:15, his usual time of departure, and she asked him to come see her when he was finished for the day. He waits for a few minutes, pointlessly checking his phone. Nobody snaps or texts him anymore. And when he finally turns to leave, he nearly collides with a woman walking into the office. "Oh," the woman says, "long shot. I forgot all about you." Chad blinks. The woman is Ms. English. But instead of being regular workday Ms. English, in her hydrangea blue blouse, the matching cardigan she often wore because she found the hotel rooms chilly, and her hair pinned back in a sensible bun, this Ms. English is wearing a hot pink silk one-shouldered top and a pair of snug white pants. Her hair is piled on her head and wrapped in a bright floral scarf, and pretty curls hang down on either side of her face. This Ms. English is also wearing cat's eye glasses bedazzled with rhinestones and a pair of platform stiletto sandals instead of the loafers that Zeke calls her auntie shoes. Chad manages to find his voice. "You look nice." "Thank you," she says. She considers him for a moment. "I have plans tonight, as you can probably guess, but my dinner's not until 8:00, so let's you and I go for a drink now, shall we?" Again, Chad is rendered speechless. Go for a drink with Ms. English? "Okay," he says. He feels himself flush. Because Ms. English is not looking like herself, but rather like some hot older woman, Chad kind of feels like she's asking him on a date. "We'll go to the Brandpoint Grill and sit at the bar," Ms. English says. "It's high time you and I had a talk." On the morning of 24th, Alessandra receives an email from Xavier Darling, addressed to her alone. "Very much looking forward to meeting you later today, Alessandra," it says. "One of our front desk's shining stars, XD. "Eccezionale," Alessandra thinks. She still has money in the bank, though not nearly as much as she'd hoped. Her rent was expensive. The impractical vehicle she bought needs a new transmission to the tune of $4,000, and she has $17,000 in credit card debt to pay off from her previous life. She wants a permanent situation. Is it crazy to think that maybe she and Xavier Darling? None of the men that Alessandra has slept with here at the hotel was wealthy or extravagant enough for her tastes, except David Yamaguchi, who, sadly, had a beautiful wife at home to whom he was very devoted. That douche canoe Bone Williams actually managed for 1 second to scare Alessandra, sending her into a period of reflection. What is she doing? She has always aspired to be different from and better than her mother. However, Alessandra admits to herself that despite the glamorous trappings of her lifestyle, living first in Europe and now Nantucket, the champagne, the pricey dinners out, the luxury goods, she's exactly the same. Only she doesn't have a daughter to show for it. Alessandra has never wanted a husband or children or a house in the suburbs or, shudder, Disney vacations. But some stability would be nice. Xavier Darling is worth $11 billion. He has homes in London, Gstaad, and St. Barth's, and apartments in New York and Singapore. He's not tall or strapping the way Alessandra likes her men, sigh, Michael Bick, but he has good posture, a kind smile, and a thick head of silver hair. Alessandra remembers reading that Xavier Darling had sunk $30 million into the hotel. It was what made her choose Nantucket over the Vineyard and Newport. At the time, she was thinking only of the wealthy clientele, though maybe subconsciously, she'd been thinking of Xavier himself. He's a little older than her usual targets, but that might be what she needs. Someone older. At 2:15, Lisbeth comes flying out of the back office. She's wearing one of her cutest dresses, Alessandra notes with approval, a white linen cartolina shift with a scalloped hem. But she's chosen her two-braid style, which makes her look like she's about to yodel. Xavier just landed, Lisbeth says. He'll be here in 20 minutes. She makes zero effort to maintain any chill, but isn't that the thing that draws people to Lisbeth, that she wears her heart on her sleeve? At least Edie is calm. Ever since Alessandra scared away Edie's predator, the one accomplishment this summer that Alessandra is proud of, Edie has focused her warmth and light on Alessandra. You're such a boss. How can I ever thank you? And Alessandra basks in it. Alessandra enjoyed nailing that jerk Graydon so much that she has even considered training to work on some kind of special victims unit. But of course, she would never pass the background check. Lisbeth poses in the entrance of the hotel like the hostess in a game show, Zeke and Raoul flanking her. Louis is playing chess in the lobby with the teenage girl staying in room 210. This girl has just finished watching The Queen's Gambit on Netflix and swears she can beat Louis, though she's lost 3 games in a row quite speedily. There's a fresh pot of coffee brewing, and Sheryl Crow is singing that all she wants to do is have a little fun before she dies. Lisbeth whips around and squeals, "He's here!" Alessandra feels her heart hop a little. She glances at Edie, who is on the phone with the R.J. Miller Salon, trying to secure a pedicure appointment for Mrs. Baskin in room 304. Alessandra taps Edie's back and tells her Xavier's here, and Edie whispers, "I'm on hold. I can't hang up. She wants this for the morning." Alessandra thinks that Edie is far more professional than she is. She would have hung up immediately. Alessandra is jealous that Edie has something to occupy her. Alessandra just smiles at the door, then checks her computer for no reason. Xavier doesn't have a reservation like other guests, and Lisbeth made his key cards hours ago. Then Alessandra hears voices, Zeke's and Lisbeth's. They both sound like stage actors. And an instant later, the man himself steps into the lobby. Well, Alessandra thinks. He's taller than Alessandra expected. Good. And he exudes a confidence that comes naturally for the very wealthy. He's wearing a cream-colored suit and a coral pink shirt open at the collar. A belt with a brushed silver buckle, nothing flashy, also good, and leather driving moccasins with woven uppers that Alessandra immediately identifies as Fratelli Rossetti. Xavier Darling's look is plucked straight from Capri. Alessandra experiences a pang for the summers of her recent past. She misses the turquoise water, diving off the bow of Giacomo's yacht in Capri, long lunches of grilled langoustines and crusty bread with fresh-pressed olive oil and salty, craggy chunks of Parmigiano. Xavier is deeply tanned, so she supposes his has been a summer well spent at the helm of his ship or in a private cabana on the beach at Il Riccio. "This is nothing short of magnificent, Elizabeth," he says, raising his arms to the antique beams, taking in the whaling boat chandelier, the James Ogilvie photograph, the beachy elegance of the lobby. "What an appealing space." Beatrice from the service kitchen appears with a deep red cocktail. It's the heartbreaker. Alessandra has heard all about it, and a tiny basket of gougere from the Blue Bar bakery box. The gougere are golden and fragrant, fresh from the oven, but no doubt cooled to the perfect temperature so that Xavier doesn't burn his tongue. When Alessandra and Xavier are together, her life will be blessed with exquisite welcomes like this. Xavier accepts the cocktail and raises his glass to the front desk. "Here's to you," he says, and he drinks. Lisbeth leads him over to meet Edie, who has just hung up the phone. She steps out from behind the desk, faces Xavier, and curtsies. Alessandra wants to cringe, but Xavier throws his head back and laughs. He and Edie shake hands, and while Lisbeth brags to Xavier, Edie was a Statler fellow at Cornell, Alessandra steps out from behind the desk and waits a respectful distance behind Edie until it's her turn to be introduced. Xavier takes a deeper interest in Edie once she mentions that she grew up on the island, and Edie draws Zeke into the conversation because Zeke was raised on Nantucket as well. Then Lisbeth tells Xavier that Zeke is an accomplished surfer and also the nephew of Magda English, head of housekeeping, and that gets Xavier's attention. He's known Magda for over 30 years, he says. Alessandra is starting to feel awkward, like a literal lady-in-waiting. However, Raoul is in a mirrored position to Alessandra behind Xavier, and his expression radiates good-natured interest in this conversation that has nothing to do with him. Alessandra takes a sustaining breath and reminds herself that she will stand on deck for as long as it takes, and when she gets into the batter's box, she will hit a grand slam. The hotel phone rings, and although Alessandra is closest, she makes no move to answer it. She hasn't met Xavier yet. She wills Edie to hear the phone and sense that she should be the one to answer it, but Edie is still deep in conversation, and Alessandra catches a pointed look from Lisbeth. She doesn't like to hear the phone ring more than twice. She goes back behind the desk to answer the phone. It's the secretary of a Mr. Iannucci, who will be checking in later that afternoon. The secretary is confirming the reservation in a pool view room for two nights. Yes, yes, confirmed. Didn't Mr. Iannucci receive the email? Alessandra knows he did, but he was probably too busy to even open it. We look forward to welcoming Mr. Iannucci this afternoon, Alessandra says. Her voice may be a touch louder than it needs to be so that Xavier will hear her superlative phone skills and realize that at least someone is working while everyone else grovels. Alessandra hangs up just as Lisbeth says, "Let me show you the break room." Edie returns to the desk, and Zeke and Raoul head back out to the entrance. "Lovely to meet you all," Xavier says. Except he hasn't met Alessandra yet. And he sent that email expressly to her, so she waits a moment and then, in a rare act of desperation, follows Xavier and Lisbeth into the break room. Xavier is standing at the pinball machine. "Hocus pocus! I played this during my one American summer back in the 70s. I lived with my aunt and uncle in Casper, Wyoming, of all places. My uncle owned a ranch there, and the local watering hole had this game." He presses the buttons on either side and the flippers clickety-clack. Xavier turns to Lisbeth. "You don't happen to have a quarter, do you?" Alessandra clears her throat. "I have one, sir." Both Xavier and Lisbeth turn around. Alessandra thinks that Lisbeth might be irked that she trailed them into the break room, but Lisbeth just smiles and in her new cheerleader voice says, "Xavier, this is Alessandra Powell, our front desk manager." Alessandra makes eye contact and shakes Xavier's hand, then pulls a quarter from behind her ear like a magician, but only Lisbeth seems impressed. Alessandra has played a lot of pinball this summer. It has given her a chance to relive her own adolescence. There was a hocus pocus at the pizza parlor in Haight-Ashbury where she used to go with Duffy. Alessandra can't think about Duffy now, though she has a friend request rotting in her Facebook account. "Here you go, Mr. Darling. It's lovely to meet you." Xavier accepts the quarter, and Alessandra waits for him to say something about her remarkable performance on the desk this summer, at which point she'll mention her previous work experience in Europe. Surely they could have an excellent conversation about Italy or Ibiza or Saint-Tropez. But Xavier simply says, "Thank you very much," and turns to the pinball machine, inserts the coin, pulls back the springy lever, and lets the first silver ball fly. The machine comes to life, all dinging bells and flashing lights. It's clear Lisbeth is going to stay and watch Xavier play, but Alessandra senses she would be pushing her luck to stay as well. She returns to the desk. Xavier and Lisbeth emerge and head out the back door to the pools. After that, Alessandra supposes, it will be down to the wellness center, over to the blue bar, then up to the owner's suite. She sees Zeke wheeling in the cart with Xavier's luggage, a garment bag, a suitcase, a weekender duffel, and she nearly offers to take it up, but how weird and obvious would that be? She'll have to think of another reason to visit Xavier's suite. She needs to have a conversation with him one-on-one. That's all it will take, Alessandra thinks. She'll dip her chin and gaze up at him. She'll touch his wrist between the cuff of his shirt and his watch. That's all it ever takes. When Lisbeth returns to the desk, she's flushed and panting, as if she's just completed an obstacle course. He's settled in, she says. He loved everything. He was so complimentary, and he noticed every detail. I'm not sure what I was worried about. This place is pretty perfect. Alessandra resists the urge to roll her eyes. Edie says, I feel like I just met royalty. He's so elegant. Elegant is the right word, Alessandra thinks. She should have been pursuing elegance, manners, breeding, experience, generosity, all along, but she'd been distracted by looks and surface charm, and that's why she hasn't landed in the right situation. Now that Alessandra has met Xavier Darling in person, she can see their future together more clearly. It will be the jet and the chauffeured Bentley, of course, but also private islands, hunting lodges in the wilds of Scotland, quiet evenings at home in Belgravia, Xavier smoking a pipe and checking the markets, Alessandra reading a first edition Dante curled up on the sofa by the fire. She'll lose her eye crystals and the white eyeliner. She'll start wearing her hair in a chignon. She'll call him X. He'll go from infatuated to besotted to deeply in love. He'll be captivated by Alessandra's intelligence, her ease with languages, her business savvy. He'll insist that she accompany him to Davos, where she'll draw the attention of the other moguls, and this sense of competition for her attention will prompt Xavier to propose. Or, if marriage frightens him, which is what Alessandra suspects, he'll appease her by changing his will, and by buying her an extraordinary diamond that proves his commitment without requiring a church ceremony. All she has to do is get up to his room. Lisbeth gasps, I forgot to give him a copy of the blue book. Well, isn't that like the sky opening up and raining gold coins? Alessandra snaps up a copy of the blue book. I'll take this up to him right now, she says. I have to drop off tickets for the drive-in to Suite 315 anyway. Alessandra waves the envelope that does, in fact, contain 4 drive-in movie tickets for the Hearn family in Suite 315. Alessandra has been holding on to them all day, just in case. An unfamiliar feeling comes over Alessandra as she approaches the door of the owner's suite. She has butterflies. She is always the pursued, never the pursuer. After she knocks, she quickly tousles her hair and arranges her face into an open, innocent smile. Xavier Darling opens the door. He has shed his jacket, but not, thankfully, his shoes, and he's holding a glass of rosé. Alessandra knows they stocked his minibar with Domaine Ott at his request. He gives her a look of vague recognition, like he's seen her somewhere before, but where? Mr. Darling, sorry to interrupt. I'm Alessandra Powell, the front desk manager. You sent me a personal email telling me how much you were looking forward to meeting me. She then realizes, with no small amount of horror, that Xavier must have sent those emails to everyone. Or, even worse, his secretary sent them on his behalf. Yes, he says crisply, maybe even a bit impatiently. Alessandra clears her throat. She has been here 10 seconds and she's already blowing it. I wanted to hand-deliver the blue book, sir. It's our recommendation guide to the island. Museums, beaches, restaurants, and the like. I say our, but this is Lisbeth's brainchild. She wrote it, and our guests have raved about it. It's something that sets us apart from the island's other luxury hotels. Alessandra tries to radiate virtue. See how I prop other women up and polish their crowns? She's mentioned it, yes. Thank you. Xavier reaches for the book, and Alessandra instinctively holds on tight. Come to me, she thinks.
If you'd like me to set up any dinner reservations or arrange for any excursions, please let me know. I'm all yours.
Ever so reluctantly, she allows him to tug the book from her. Xavier riffles through the pages.
I'll take a look when I have a moment.
I'm at your disposal if you need dinner.
I had everything booked for me weeks ago.
Xavier steps back and takes hold of the door. He seems like he's about to close it in her face.
Thank you, Alexandra.
That's it, she thinks. He didn't show the slightest interest. He didn't flirt, didn't wink, didn't smile. His eyes didn't linger. He wasn't intrigued, wasn't attracted. He didn't even get her name right.
When Alessandra gets back to the desk, she isn't thinking straight. Edie is on the phone, so there's no immediate follow-up questioning about how it went, although Alessandra is tempted to confide in Edie because she needs a friend. But what would she say? I've been trying to find a suitable man all summer, someone who will make my life easier. Edie will be appalled. Edie is idealistic, not only about marrying for love, but also about women making their own way in the world. What kind of dinosaur pursues a sugar daddy? I can't meet a regular guy and lead a normal middle-class life. I'm not programmed that way. I need someone of Xavier's caliber, and there are only a certain number of straight, unattached billionaire men, Edie.
Just as she is about to admit defeat, she'll be a hotel desk clerk forever. Her beauty will wash out like an old master's painting left in direct sunlight. She'll die alone with her broken dreams. She remembers that she has a ripcord. She slips into the break room and pulls out her phone. She feels a sharp stab of guilt because she's standing at the very counter where she and Edie fought back against exactly the kind of blackmail that Alessandra is about to initiate. But sorry, she's desperate. She finds the pictures of herself in the Bick's house on Hulbert Avenue and sends them in separate text messages to Michael Bick.
I need 50,000 more, she types. Otherwise, these go to your wife.
She'd like to claim cramps and go home, but there's only an hour left in her shift and she's dependent on Raoul for a ride because of her Jeep's crapped out transmission. So she decides to show some grit and finish the day. She feels she's made the right decision and is, perhaps, being rewarded when a good-looking, broad-shouldered gentleman pulling a roller bag and carrying an attaché case steps into the lobby. He glances from Edie to Alessandra, and although Alessandra has stopped treating the front desk like a beauty pageant or a popularity contest, she smiles at the gentleman and he grins and strolls right over to her.
Good boy, Alessandra thinks.
In seconds, he'll be eating out of her hand.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Hotel Nantucket, she says. Checking in?
Screw you, Xavier, darling, she thinks. You lost out. The gentleman pulls out his driver's license, Robert Iannucci from Holliston, Massachusetts, and a gold American Express.
Bob Iannucci, he says, here for two nights.
He winks at her.
Your name tag is upside down.
Ah, you noticed. I'm Alessandra, the front desk manager. What a pleasure to meet you.
Bob Iannucci, Italian, she likes it, isn't wearing a wedding ring. Alessandra gets him checked in, thinking,
gold card, not platinum card. A room, not a suite. And Holliston is a Boston suburb. A nice suburb, but a suburb just the same.
Bob Iannucci isn't worth going after, but Alessandra needs an ego boost. Oh, does she? And so, when she slides Bob Iannucci his key cards, she attaches a yellow sticky note with her number on it and says,
if you need any help with dinner reservations, just let me know. That's my personal cell phone. I'm here for whatever you need.
Bob Iannucci peels the sticky note off the keycard envelope and regards it with a bemused expression.
Are you soliciting me? He asks.
Alessandra runs her gaze over Bob Iannucci and notices things she overlooked in her haste. His blandly corporate look, gray suit pants, white shirt, navy striped tie, Seiko watch, his tight military-style haircut, his close shave, his square jaw, and his direct gaze, and she thinks, oh God. She can't believe she didn't notice it right off the bat. This guy is a cop. Or worse, a detective.
What? She says. No.
She laughs, and Bob Iannucci laughs and says, "Oh, too bad." And the whole thing becomes a joke, and Bob Iannucci rolls his bag onto the elevator, and when the doors close, Alessandra turns to Edie and says, "I feel like the green puke emoji, I'm sorry." Edie says, "Go home, girl. I got this." Alessandra wants to hug Edie. She is so grateful, but she doesn't want to get Edie sick. And so she just collects her bag and scoots out the doors into the bright and newly confusing world. Chapter 23, Full Send. The Brant Point Grill is the restaurant at the White Elephant Hotel and Resort, the Hotel Nantucket's rival, so it seems like an odd choice for drinks. But Ms. English picked it, and who is Chad to argue? The spacious bar has a lot of dark wood and big mirrors, and the clientele is older and more sophisticated than the places Chad frequents, or frequented in his past life. There's a jazz combo playing in the corner, piano, drums, stand-up bass. Past the bar, Chad can see the elegant dining room where enormous windows offer a vista of the flat blue sheet of Nantucket Harbor, dotted with boats. Chad has been to the restaurant before with his parents, an Easter brunch one year when Paul and Whitney thought it would be fun to visit the island in the off-season. But Chad remembers that he and Leith had been disenchanted by the whole experience. It was cold enough for them to need winter parkas on April 9th, and everything was still closed downtown, including the juice bar and their yacht club, which was how they'd ended up at the Brant Point Grill. Ms. English leads Chad to two seats at the long bar, ones that are in front of a mirror, which means that Chad is confronted with the reflection of himself sitting next to his now fancy boss in a bar. "What would you like, Longshot?" Ms. English asks. "Drinks are on me." "I can pay," Chad says. Ms. English laughs. She motions for the bartender, who hurries over to take their order. "The usual, neat for me, Brian."
"Appleton Estate 21, Magda, you got it," Brian says with a wink.
They know each other, Chad thinks. Ms. English comes here, to the rival hotel's restaurant. He supposes it's better than getting a drink at the Blue Bar, where Ms. English is still sort of at work and where everyone knows her. Another good thing about the Brant Point Grill, he realizes, is that they're anonymous, surrounded by another hotel's guests.
"I'll have a..."
Chad is hesitant to order his usual, a vodka soda, because that's the stereotypical Chad drink. At the long-ago brunch, his parents ordered Bloody Marys, which came extravagantly garnished, one with a lobster tail on a skewer and one with a cheeseburger slider. But Chad doesn't want to inflate Ms. English's bar tab with an expensive drink.
"A beer," he says. "Whale's tail, if you have it on draft?"
"We do," Brian says. He sidles away to make the drinks. Although Chad is dying to ask Ms. English the question that's reverberating through his mind, he knows enough to wait until their drinks have been set before them and they've raised their glasses to each other.
"Thank you for inviting me," Chad says.
"Thank you for coming, Longshot. This is way overdue."
"Is it?" Chad thinks. There's no time to consider how long Ms. English has been wanting to invite him for drinks because the urge to know what happened to Bibi is overwhelming.
"So what?"
"Barbara gave her notice at the beginning of last week," Ms. English says. "She was accepted at UMass Dartmouth with a scholarship and she's going to pursue a degree in criminal justice."
"What?" Chad says. "She is?"
"Yes, how about that? She forwarded me her acceptance email, I fear because she thought I wouldn't believe her. Her first day of classes was today."
Bibi wasn't fired. She didn't go on the lam looking for Johnny Quarter. She wasn't bullied by Octavia and Nevis. That was a crazy theory. She was going to college on a scholarship. Chad is embarrassed to find tears gathering in his eyes. He's so proud of her.
"Why didn't she tell me?" Chad says.
Mixed in with his emotions is the sting of betrayal. Bibi just walked off the day before like everything was normal. "See ya, Longshot."
"She wanted me to tell you," Ms. English says. "She was afraid of a messy goodbye, I think. Some people are like that."
Ms. English nudges Chad with her elbow.
"And the two of you grew so close this summer," It wasn't like that, Chad says. He drinks deeply from his beer. It's the first drink he's had since May 22nd, and it gives him an instant buzz. We were friends.
You are more than friends, Ms. English says. You planted that belt in the laundry in order to protect her.
No, I didn't, Chad wants to say. But he can't lie, so he shrugs.
I take it that belt belonged to your mother, Ms. English says. Has she missed it?
Ha, no.
The last thing Chad is worried about is Whitney missing her belt.
I thought Bibi might have taken the belt and I didn't want her to get in trouble.
All of my cleaners are extremely honest people, Ms. English says, with squeaky clean resumes. I see to that.
What about me? Chad asks.
He finishes his beer. He probably drank it more quickly than he should have. Without his even asking, another one arrives in its place.
Did you do any background research on me?
No, Ms. English says. You, I hired out of desperation.
She laughs, and Chad has to smile.
I had a feeling about you, but it was a gamble.
That's why I call you Longshot.
Yes, Chad gets it. Preppy dudes from wealthy families don't clean hotel rooms, except this summer one did, and he did it well, he thinks.
Thank you for taking the chance, he says. This summer helped me.
Helped you? Ms. English says.
Chad stares into his beer, then takes a long swallow.
Remember at my interview, I told you I messed up?
Yes, Longshot, I do. I'll admit, I've wondered about that statement periodically over the summer. You're such a hard worker. Conscientious, respectful, prompt, responsible, and, as I noticed in regard to your relationship with Barbara, thoughtful and kind. I can't imagine you being otherwise.
Oh, but I was, Chad says. I was otherwise.
Ms. English pats his back lightly. You don't have to share, she says, unless you want to, in which case I will listen with rapt interest. Chad thinks it over. He has done everything right this summer, but he hasn't taken the most important step in moving on. He hasn't talked about what happened with anyone. Share, the word Ms. English used, makes him feel like she'll accept part of the burden he's been carrying around.
Something happened this spring, Chad says, on May 22nd.
On the morning of May 22nd, Chad woke up freshly graduated from Bucknell University with gentleman's C's, looking at a delicious, responsibility-free summer on Nantucket with his parents and his sister, Leith, before he joined his father's company, the Brandywine Group, in September. Chad's parents were driving to the Deerfield Academy to pick up Leith, who had just finished her junior year. Paul and Whitney Winslow were making an overnight trip of it because they liked to include a romantic stay at the Mayflower Inn. Chad didn't like to dwell on this, obviously. They were his parents. All he cared about was having the house in Radnor to himself so he could throw a little graduation party. Before his parents left, his mother kissed his cheek and said, "Please be good, Chaddy. And remember to take Lulu out every 2 hours. She can't make it to the door by herself anymore, so you'll have to carry her."
"I will," Chad said.
Lulu was their 15-year-old dachshund whom Chad loved like another sibling. He would be good to the dog, but TBH, he couldn't wait for his parents to leave. He'd invited everyone he'd ever known to the party, including a bunch of guys from Bucknell, some of whom had road-tripped for hours to get to the Winslow home. Chad wanted the event to be a step up from the parties he'd thrown in high school, so he bought steaks to throw on the grill, and a bunch of the girls he invited showed up with potato salad and guacamole. Tindley Akers, whom Chad had known since nursery school, brought pot brownies. Chad sampled one as an appetizer, and it sent him flying. After dinner, Chad started a bonfire in the fire pit while a bunch of kids splashed around in the pool. Things got wilder from there. Honestly, Chad couldn't remember all the details. He knelt for the full send beer funnel multiple times. He did shots of Jägermeister and hoovered cocaine off the vanity in the downstairs powder room. That became a joke. Meet me in the powder room. Though Chad felt guilty when he looked at his mother's little embroidered towels and fancy soaps. Thinking about his mother made Chad remember the dog. He was supposed to take her out every 2 hours. And how long had it been? He found Lulu on her bed on the screened-in porch. Chad dutifully carried her outside, let her whiz, and then set her back on her plaid Orvis bed. She looked so old and forlorn that Chad almost wanted to tell everyone to go home while he and Lulu snuggled on the sectional in the rec room to watch Family Guy. That was their thing. Chad was certain that Lulu understood the show because it always held her rapt attention. But what was he, nuts? It was a party. His friends were here. Still, he couldn't just leave Lulu to wallow in her old dog misery, so he went in search of a rawhide or a treat, which required a trip to the basement, where Chad's attention was snagged by his parents' wine cave. They pronounced it cove, which made Chad and Leith cringe. He snatched a bottle of champagne off the rack, and upstairs, he grabbed a 10-inch chef's knife from the kitchen. In Chad's final week of school, his professor of French culture had shown the class how to saber the top off a bottle of champagne. Chad ran outside to the deck, but the party was so out of control, there was no way to get anyone's attention. Everyone was in or around the pool, swimming, drinking, smoking, making out, dancing. The outdoor speaker blasted Pop Smoke's What You Know About Love. Chad ran the blade of the knife along the throat of the champagne bottle, just as Professor Legree had shown them, then hit the bottle with the blade and, whoosh, the top of the bottle sliced off, neat and clean. Bubbles spewed over Chad's fingers. He enjoyed one split second of blissful satisfaction. The sabering worked. This was a party trick he could use for the rest of his life, before he saw his college roommate and best friend Patty hunched over, holding his face. Somehow, without even knowing, Chad knew. He ran over to Patty. "You okay, man?" There was blood spurting out of the fingers that Patty was holding over his left eye. The cork and the top of the bottle with its thick glass edge had hit Patty in the face. "Call 911!" Chad shouted, but nobody heard him, and Chad's phone was over by the outdoor speaker controlling the music. He grabbed the nearest person, Tindley, as it turned out, and called the ambulance from her phone. Patty wasn't making any noise, and he was as white as a sheet. Tindley had the presence of mind to bring Patty a damp towel for his eye. Chad held Patty's arm, the one that wasn't pressed to his face, and wished like hell the cork had hit anyone but Patty. Patty Farrell was not only Chad's best friend, he was a genuinely good and smart person. He'd been a scholarship student at Bucknell. His dad was a long-haul trucker, and his mom worked as a legal secretary. They lived in a town of 400 called Grimesland, North Carolina. "I'm so sorry, man," Chad said, wondering why the hell he had sabered the champagne when there were people around. How irresponsible was that? He hadn't noticed Patty sitting on the deck. That was the thing. Patty must have been alone in the dark, which made Chad feel even worse. Patty didn't know anyone at the party besides the three other Bucknell guys, and he was quiet by nature. Patty had driven up from Grimesland at Chad's insistence. "You have to come, man. There are going to be so many girls." When the ambulance arrived, some people scattered, thinking it was the police. Chad grabbed his phone but left the music playing and climbed into the back of the ambulance with Patty, who kept insisting he didn't need to go to the hospital and shouldn't go because his parents didn't have that kind of health insurance. "I'll pay for it, man. It was my fault," Chad said. The paramedic, a woman named Christy, who was actually kind of hot, managed to pry Patty's hand away from his eye. She said, matter-of-factly, "That's going to need surgery."
"I can't," Patty said, "afford it." "I'll pay for it," Chad said again,
and he thought about how what he meant was that his parents, who at that very moment were probably gazing across a candlelit table at each other, splitting a chocolate mousse, would pay for it. They would find out about the party unless Chad got everyone out of there pronto. He wondered how bad it would be if he didn't go to the hospital with Patty and instead stayed home and did damage control. Bad, he thought. And for the first time in a long time, maybe ever, said a prayer. When they got to the hospital, Patty was rushed away. Chad heard someone mention an eye specialist. He was buzzing from the cocaine, but also drunk and high and teetering on the edge of paranoia. A nurse gave him a form to fill out, but he knew only some of the answers. He needed to call Patty's parents or his own, but he was waiting to see what the doctors said. He was hoping it would turn out to be just stitches and a shiner. When he handed the clipboard back to the nurse, he said, "Whatever this costs, I'll pay for it. Just make sure he gets the best care." They were at Bryn Mawr Hospital, which was where Chad had been born. He hadn't had a reason to return here in 22 years, and neither had anyone else in his family. They were just that fortunate, so fortunate, that Chad almost broke down crying. But instead, he stumbled over to the water fountain and tried to suck it dry. His phone rang. It was Raj, which was not unexpected. After Patty, Raj was the next nicest guy that Chad knew. Raj was from Potomac, Maryland, and he was super smart and driven. His parents were doctors. He was probably calling to see how Patty was, but Chad couldn't talk to him yet. He didn't want to talk to anyone until he knew Patty was going to be okay. He declined the call. Raj immediately called back, and when Chad declined again, Raj texted, "Pick up, bruh, it's urgent." "I can't talk," Chad texted back, "waiting room." Raj sent a fire emoji, which Chad ignored. Then Raj called again and Chad whispered into the phone, "What?" Raj said, "Someone set your house on fire." Chad hung up. Raj was drunk, stoned, high, and he thought he was being funny, great. A man in blue scrubs entered the waiting room. "Chadwick Winslow?" he said. Chad raised his hand like he was in fourth grade. The man approached and said, "Dr. Harding, nice to meet you. You're here with Patrick?" Chad nodded. "He's gone into surgery. The cornea appears to have been sliced. We're going to try to save the eye, but there's a better than not chance Patrick will have partial to full vision loss." Chad gagged, but no, he couldn't uke here in the waiting room. He breathed in through his nose. "I want to pay for it." Chad's phone rang. It was Raj again. Dr. Harding clapped Chad on the shoulder and said, "We're keeping him overnight. Why don't you go home and get some rest? One of our nurses has contacted Patrick's family." No, Chad thought. He'd met Mr. and Mrs. Farrell a handful of times. They weren't fancy or sophisticated like Chad's parents, but they were kind, decent people. Patty had an older brother, Griffin, who was in the U.S. Navy, stationed in Honolulu. They FaceTimed once a week. The doctor disappeared back down the hall, and when Chad pulled his phone out to call an Uber, he saw another text from Raj. "Your house caught on fire. The fire department put it out, but the deck and the screened-in porch are torched. You need to come home right now. Your neighbors are here. Also, man, I hate to say this in a text, but your dog is dead." "Lulu," Chad thought, and for a second, he couldn't breathe. Chad's phone rang again. The screen said, "Dad." "I burned down part of my house," Chad says to Ms. English. "That was the least awful thing I did. I killed my dog, whom I loved so much, whom my whole family loved, and my sister still won't speak to me. She hates me." He gets an aching lump in his throat. "All I can think about is Lulu's fur catching on fire or her coughing from the smoke." He stops. It was so terrible, and it was all his fault. He pushes his beer away. He thought he'd be okay to drink again, but now his stomach is churning just like it did that night at the hospital. "And my best friend, a guy I loved like a brother and always wanted to protect, a guy who was kind of like Bibi, because he didn't come from a background like mine, lost his vision in his left eye. Forever. And we're not friends anymore. I haven't heard from him since he went back home." Chad had stayed at the hospital until his parents and Patty's parents had shown up. Patty underwent surgery and was released 2 days later. When the nurse wheeled him out with a patch over one eye, Chad started apologizing, insisting it was an accident. He hadn't seen Patty sitting there, but he could hear his voice ricocheting off a new steeliness encapsulating Patty that Chad hoped was just the painkillers, but that turned out to be anger. You're shallow, thoughtless, and oblivious to your own privilege. You didn't check to see who was sitting around you when you sliced the top off a glass bottle with a 10-inch chef's knife because you didn't care. Anyone sitting in your direct line of fire would have been in your way, spoiling your fun, and we both know nothing and no one means more to Chad Winslow than fun. Your whole existence is filled with empty, meaningless pleasure, and this will continue to be true because no one is ever going to hold you accountable. You'll never develop character, and you won't go to heaven or hell because you don't have a soul. Patty had been at least partially right. Nobody held Chad accountable. His parents did extreme damage control, calling in a favor at the Philadelphia Inquirer so the incident didn't make the papers, and personally phoning the parents of every kid who attended the party and promising favors in exchange for their kid's silence or threatening lawsuits because someone, Chad still doesn't know who, threw a can of lighter fluid into the fire pit. The can exploded, and burning fragments sliced through the screen of the porch and instantly ignited the sisal rug and the drapes and the dog bed. Chad overheard his mother lying to people on the phone, saying they'd put Lulu down. She was so old and feeble, poor thing. Patty didn't tell anyone anything. He returned to Grimesland, which was far, far away from the gossip channels of the main line. "I didn't get in any trouble," Chad says. "My parents were angry, of course, and they were disappointed. But mostly, they were worried about how the incident would reflect on them. They thought everyone would say they were bad parents, and so they did what they could to sweep it under the rug. They bought me a brand new Range Rover as a graduation present, and it was delivered to my house the day after Patty went home. So it felt like I had done all these heinous things and was rewarded." Chad shakes his head and his eyes flood with hot tears as he thinks, what the actual f— Ms. English lays a cool hand on his arm. "But you corrected course on your own," she says. "You came to me, and I put you to work in a place where we don't sweep anything under the rug." Chad wipes his eyes with the back of his hand. "You told me that you believed even the biggest messes could be cleaned up." "And that's what you did," she says. "I'm sure your parents are very proud of you." "They're not, though," Chad says. "Neither one of them has praised me for getting this job. My father told me to quit." "But you didn't quit," Ms. English says, "because you do have character, Longshot." "I don't want to work at my father's company," Chad says. "I want to stay at the hotel until it closes for the season." Ms. English tisks, "You have to get on with your life." "But I don't want—" They're interrupted by a silver-haired gentleman in a pink shirt who puts a hand on Ms. English's back and says, "Hello, Magda." Ms. English rises from her stool and offers the gentleman her hand. He kisses it like someone in the movies, and Chad thinks, who is this dude? The guy is gazing at Ms. English like she's a Victoria's Secret angel, and Chad feels uncomfortable, like he's the one interrupting them, not the other way around, and protective, too. He gets to his feet. "Hi," he says, "I work for Ms. English." The gentleman turns to Chad, then looks at Ms. English.
"This is your long shot?"
Ms. English chuckles.
"It is indeed. Xavier, please meet Chadwick Winslow. Chadwick, this is Xavier Darling."
Mario's I Love You playlist for Lisbeth. XO, Beyonce. Let My Love Open the Door, Pete Townsend. Whatever It Is, Zac Brown Band. Never Tear Us Apart, INXS. Come to Me, Goo Goo Dolls. Everlong, Foo Fighters. Head Over Feet, Alanis Morissette. Never Let You Go, Third Eye Blind. Wonderful Tonight, Eric Clapton. Swing Life Away, Rise Against. Something, The Beatles. You're My Home, Billy Joel. I Believe, Stevie Wonder. Better Together, Luke Combs. You and Me, Lifehouse. All I Want Is You, You Too. In My Feelings, Drake. Lay Me Down, Dirty Heads. Sunshine, World Party. Crazy Love, Van Morrison. Stand by My Woman. Lenny Kravitz. It's late on the night of the 24th. So late it's the 25th. And Mario slips between the sheets of Lisbeth's bed and starts the ritual of unbraiding her hair. He likes the way it looks, all kinked and long, so she indulges him. Lisbeth isn't fully awake, but her desire stirs at the feel of his hands in her hair, his front pressed against her back. Because she's in that liminal state between waking and sleeping, her animal instincts emerge, and she loses all inhibition. Their lovemaking is a storm, and this night she hears the tapping of rain on her cottage's roof, then the tree branches swiping at her windows, then a sharp crack followed by a grumble of thunder. Lisbeth's and Mario's bodies move over the bed in a darkness that's briefly illuminated by flashes of lightning. It's cinematic, she thinks. How beautiful they are in those split seconds when their bodies are silvered by the electrical charge in the air. Afterward, they lie flat on the bottom sheet, the duvet kicked to the floor, and Lisbeth wonders if she's ever been this happy. She has focused all of her energy not on fighting the old, but on building the new, just as the sign at the end of her bed has been urging her to do for nearly an entire calendar year. She wishes that back on September 30th, she could have somehow known that one day she would be lying in bed next to Mario freaking Subiaco, after having impressed the hell out of the new owner of the Hotel Nantucket, where she was the general manager. Would she have believed it? Mario expels a breath. I love you, he says. The rain has stopped, the wind has died down, the lightning and thunder have rolled past. What? Lisbeth says, though of course she heard him perfectly. Mario faces her. I love you, he says. I'm in love with you. He starts laughing. I honestly can't believe it. I'm, what, 46, almost 47? And in all those years, I've told only three other women I loved them. One was Allie Taylor in sixth grade. And yes, that was real love, the purest kind, awkward and unrequited. One was my mother, of course. And the third was Fiona. I loved Fee, but that was different. Because although I would have lain down in traffic for her, we weren't romantically involved. Lisbeth's heart feels like an exploding star in her chest. She realizes it's time for her to say it back, but she wants to hear more. How can you be so sure with me? She says. Explain yourself. Working backward, Mario says. When you ended things a few weeks ago, I thought, okay, she's not ready. No problem. Things had gotten serious pretty quickly, and I knew you were coming off this other relationship, so I told myself I understood. But I was hurt by it, which was a new feeling for me, or new since sixth grade when Allie Taylor went to the Valentine's Day dance with Will Chandler instead of me. He grins. Lisbeth touches his face. He loves her. Before that, I wouldn't say it was love at first sight, but when I saw you in the parking lot that first day in those sexy heels telling JJ to leave you alone, even though the dude was down on one knee proposing, I thought, that poor guy blew it, but I'm not going to. Stop, Lisbeth says, though she's grinning. Before that, Mario says. There was no before that, Lisbeth says. That was the day we met. Before that, Xavier told me that he'd hired a lioness named Elizabeth Keaton to manage the hotel. He said you used to run the deck with your boyfriend, but that you'd parted ways and you were looking for a fresh start. Lioness? Lisbeth says. Direct quote. You don't forget a description like that. I was so intrigued that I did some stalking. I saw the feature about you and JJ and coastal living, then I checked out the deck's website, and I developed a little crush on you.
You did not.
I did, Mario says. You reminded me of Allie Taylor. Lisbeth swats him and he says, I'm serious. She had blonde hair like yours and pale blue eyes and that sweet but tough thing going that I haven't encountered in any other woman until I met you. I always said I was going to find Allie Taylor someday and marry her. Lisbeth is starting to feel a little jealous of Allie Taylor.
But when I checked Facebook, I saw she was married with 4 kids at private schools in Manhattan, and I also realized I was happy for her in that life. The magic was gone. But when I look at you?
Here, Mario traces his finger from Lisbeth's shoulder down her arm.
I feel like I'm 12 years old again, and everything is shiny and new and colorful and full of wonder. And that's how I know that I love you.
I love you too, Lisbeth says.
There's a reason why I'm telling you tonight, Mario says, even though I've been in love with you for most of the summer.
What's the reason? She says.
Xavier was crazy about the bar. Our numbers are good, and you said he was happy with the hotel.
He raved, Lisbeth says.
So today it finally felt real, Mario says. It felt sustainable, like I can dig in here. I can stay here and do my thing with the bar, and you can run the hotel. And in the off season, we can go wherever the spirit moves us. I still own a place in LA. It's a bungalow with a little pool out back and an avocado tree.
An avocado tree? Lisbeth says.
She kisses Mario and pulls the duvet onto the bed.
All she wants is to go to sleep dreaming of swimming pools and movie stars, an avocado tree, and some craftsman furniture in Mario's bungalow. Tomorrow, she will still have to charm Xavier, still have to make sure everything is beyond the beyond for him. A hotel experience isn't made in one afternoon or even one night. Lisbeth closes her eyes, and Mario starts breathing deeply, but Lisbeth can't settle. She's in a happy bubble, insulated and safe. But isn't there the teeniest tear threatening to deflate it? Well, she thinks, the last Friday of the month is only 2 days away, which means a new hotel confidential post. Either Shelley Carpenter has stayed with them or she hasn't. If she has and she gives them less than 5 keys, or if she hasn't and doesn't review them at all, what will happen?
Chapter 24. Heartbreaker. Xavier Darling is out to dinner, and so Grace spends the evening doing a few minor hauntings. She's able to delight Mary Perkowski from Ohio by flickering the lights, then playing Mary's favorite song, Thunder Road, spontaneously over the sound system, then by making the shears of the canopy bed sway like the dress in the song. Next, it's off to Suite 114, where Grace peeks in on the Marsh children, who will be leaving in the morning. Today marked Louie's last chess lesson with Rustum, and Wanda returned her Nancy Drew books to the library. She made it all the way to number 45, the Spider Sapphire Mystery. Kimber isn't exactly an organized packer. She has been stuffing things in bags indiscriminately, a process that was interrupted by moments of her sitting on the bed with her face in her hands or writing her memoirs on her laptop with tears streaming down her face. Grace has grown attached to Kimber and Wanda and Louie, and even Doug. She can't imagine the hotel without them, but it's the very nature of a hotel to be impermanent. Hello, then goodbye. That's how it goes. If people stayed forever, it would be a home. Grace moves in close to Wanda, the only supernaturally sensitive person in the past 100 years who has wanted to understand her. Grace kisses her cheek, leaving behind a cool damp spot. Wanda's eyes flutter open. Grace. I'm here, sweet child, Grace thinks. Then Doug growls. He's such a crank with her, though Grace likes knowing he'll protect Wanda. And Grace leaves the room. Nighty-night. She floats up 2 floors and across the hall to the owner's suite, a place she has consciously avoided all summer long, and sure enough, it triggers her right away. Despite the fact that it's bright and white and beachy modern now, Grace can picture her 19-year-old self crouched on the ground, trying to coax the damn cat, Mittens, out from under the bed. She's thinking that a woman who would throw a silver candlestick at her own pet is a woman with a turd for a heart. Grace hears the door open. In her mind, it's Jackson Benedict, come to sweet-talk Grace, kiss her, and press her hand to his crotch.
and she will, in that instant, know she's ruined. But she will not yet know that she's doomed. It's not Jackson Benedict who steps into the suite. Obviously not. Jack has been dead for decades, but Xavier Darling with none other than Magda English. Well, Grace thinks. This is something of a reprise, the owner of the hotel with the housekeeping staff. Except Magda isn't merely housekeeping staff. She is, in modern parlance, a girl boss. No one pushes Magda around or tells her what to do, not even a man with $11 billion like Xavier Darling. Xavier turns on the lights in the living area. They're on dimmers and cast a romantic, honeyed glow. He raises the room-darkening shades on the picture window so they can see over Easton Street to Nantucket Harbor and the ruby beacon of Brant Point Light. Champagne? Xavier says. There's a bottle of Paul Roger relaxing in an ice bath on the burled walnut coffee table, and Magda says, "You know I never turn down champagne, Xavier." Xavier opens the bottle with a flourish. He pours two flutes. Then he and Magda settle on the sofa together and raise their glasses. "To the hotel," Magda says. They drink.
"I bought it for you, you know," Xavier says.
This makes Magda hoot with laughter.
"I'm serious," Xavier says. "When you worked on my ships, I knew where to find you."
"You were always so subtle about it," Magda says, "landing your helicopter on the bow or hot-dogging in your cigarette boat. I'll never forget you pulling up to the docks in that devil when I went ashore in Ischia."
She caresses his face. "You used to be so dashing." Xavier sighs.
"I'm still pretty dashing, no? As soon as you told me you were retiring and moving to Nantucket, I did some research and found the hotel. I wanted to make it grand for you."
He sips his champagne.
"Another woman might be flattered."
"Another woman might think you were trying to control her."
"No one can control you," Xavier says. "Of all the women I've known in my life, you are the one who has haunted me."
"Ha, ha, ha," Grace thinks. "Now there's a choice of words."
"You're so independent, so elusive."
Magda puts a finger to Xavier's lips. He takes her hand and pulls her in for a kiss. The flutes of champagne are set down. Magda and Xavier move for each other in such haste that Xavier's knee jostles the table. His flute topples and champagne spills across the burled surface of the table and drips down onto the Persian rug. But neither Xavier nor Magda, with her eagle eye for cleanliness, seems to notice. Downstairs at the front desk, the phone rings, but Richie isn't at his post. No, he's in Lisbeth's office on his cell phone. Again? Grace thinks. This must be a response to Kimber and the children leaving. She feels both sad and disappointed. Richie's actions were so wholesome while he was enthralled to the romance. These calls had completely stopped. Richie doesn't answer the hotel phone the first time it rings, nor does he answer it when the same people call back. Richie can see from checking the phone on Lisbeth's desk that it's the Sparacinos in Suite 316. When the Sparacinos call back a third time, Richie abruptly finishes the call on his cell phone and picks up.
"Good evening, front desk,"
he says as smoothly as a late-night DJ. Mrs. Sparacino huffs. "There's a couple making quite a lot of noise in Suite 317. My husband has tried knocking on the wall, but they don't seem to get the hint. Would you call them, please? Ask them to be a little quieter." Richie assures Mrs. Sparacino that he will. But then it dawns on him that the guest in Suite 317 is Xavier Darling. Grace waits what she hopes is a sufficient amount of time for the passion to play out before returning to Suite 317. Thankfully, Magda and Xavier are now tucked neatly under the covers, snuggled in among the pillows, enjoying their afterglow.
"I realize you love your work here," Xavier says.
"I certainly do," Magda says. "I loved it on the ships, and I enjoy it even more here on land."
"But Magda, you have so much money.
You've seen the latest statements.
We're well past the 20 million mark.
He tickles her under the covers, and she giggles like a girl before swatting him away.
You've come a long way from the night we met.
I won nearly a quarter million that night, Magda says. I put down my own hard-earned money. I placed the bets. I rolled the dice.
But you invested it with my people.
Yes, you helped me build the fortune. It's possible that I've never really felt entitled to the money for that reason, although don't get me wrong, it's nice knowing it's there.
I'd like to see you enjoy it,
Xavier says. Magda sits up straighter and checks her hair. Strands have fallen out of her bun, and she tucks them back in.
We're a lot alike. You have $11 billion, and you won't stop working until you're dead.
I'll retire immediately if you agree to marry me,
Xavier says. Magda squawks.
What kind of foolish thing is that to say?
I've been in love with you since the second I met you on that ship. I know you want to be close to Zeke and William, but it's been nearly a year. I'm sure they only want you to be happy. Marry me, Magda. Come to London.
Eee!
Grace thinks. She's swirling around the room like a funnel cloud. Xavier loves Magda. He's proposing. And unlike Jack, who promised Grace every time he visited the storage closet that he would divorce Dahlia and marry her, Xavier means it. He probably already has a ring picked out. Xavier reaches over to his nightstand, opens the little curved drawer, and produces a box from Harry Winston. He sits up in bed, the covers still, thankfully, smooth across his lap, and presents the box to Magda.
What have you done, Xavier? She says.
I went all in, Xavier says. Open it.
Magda opens the box to reveal a movie star engagement ring. It's a light pink oval diamond. Grace doesn't know carrots from carrots, but it's big, in a setting of pave diamonds and rose gold.
Well, Magda says.
Try it on.
Magda snaps the box closed.
Oh, Xavier, I can't try it on. I'm not going to marry you. I think you're a wonderful man, and I'm very grateful for all you've done for me.
She stares up at the exact spot Grace is hovering. Grace holds her gaze, even though she knows that all Magda sees is the Nantucket night sky painted on the ceiling.
I consider you a dear friend. You make me laugh. I enjoy your company and a little roll in the hay, because at my age, I'm happy I can still roll. But I don't love you. I do love this hotel and this job and being able to keep an eye on Zeke and William. I've been looking at some real estate on Eel Point Road, houses with ocean views and a pool and gardens. I haven't found the right one yet, but my plan, Xavier, is to stay here. I'm happy here.
You're turning me down? Xavier says.
Magda presses her palm to his cheek.
Yes, she says. I'm turning you down, sweet man. I'm sorry.
Grace leaves the suite and spirits back up to the fourth floor storage closet. If only she'd had the courage and self-assurance to say those words 100 years earlier.
I'm turning you down, Mr. Benedict. I'm sorry.
She would have gone on to live a full life. But those words hadn't been available to Grace in 1922. She feels proud now, not only of Magda, but of womankind. There's been progress made this century. Grace chuckles. She suspects Wanda will be turning down men left and right. Lisbeth has arranged for Yolanda to take Xavier up to Great Point on Thursday. In Lisbeth's opinion, Great Point is the ultimate Nantucket destination, and Yolanda's classic Bronco is as cool a vehicle as exists on this island. Lisbeth asked Beatrice to prepare a picnic of chilled lobster rolls, yellow tomato gazpacho, corn salad, and some of Mario's church picnic eggs in a proper hamper with a bottle or two of Domaine Haute, Xavier's favorite rosé. Lisbeth wonders if Xavier will ask her to go along, since he barely knows Yolanda. She would love to say yes. She has been yearning to stretch out on the sand all summer. But of course, she has to stay at the hotel and make sure things run smoothly. Maybe he'll invite Edie to go. They seem to hit it off. Or his old friend Magda. Lisbeth can't really spare Magda today or any day, though she'll have to if Xavier asks. The only person Lisbeth does not want to see go on a day trip with Xavier is Alessandra. The way she threw herself at him in the break room was embarrassing. Lisbeth gets to work early, but apparently not early enough, because when she walks into her office, there's a note on the desk from Xavier. He's gone. What? Lisbeth shouts. The note says simply, "Had to leave the island unexpectedly. So sorry. XD." She bursts out to the desk, but no one is there. It's 7 o'clock. Richie is spending his last morning with Kimber and the kids before they leave on the ferry. Edie and Alessandra won't arrive for another 15 minutes, and neither will Adam and Zeke. The only person in the lobby is Louis. He's at his usual place at the chessboard by the front window, playing against himself. Even at this early hour, he's dressed in his little polo shirt with his blonde hair combed and parted. Lisbeth approaches. Louis has been in the lobby every day since June 6th, an 81-day streak, and Lisbeth hasn't found the time to play him in chess even once. She feels bad about this, but she can't dwell on it now. "Louis," she says, "did you see an older gentleman with silver hair here in the lobby earlier?" Louis blinks behind the thick lenses of his glasses.
"You mean Mr. Darling?"
"Yes," Lisbeth says. "You saw him?" Louis moves a pawn.
"I beat him in 16 moves, he shrugs. "He wasn't bad."
"You played chess with him this morning?"
"A while ago," Louis says. "Then his driver came in, and Mr. Darling asked the driver to take our picture because he said I'm going to be famous someday. Then he left."
He left. Lisbeth calls Xavier from her office. "Xavier," she says, "is everything okay?" She's afraid something went wrong, and Xavier is too much of a gentleman to tell her. Was the bed uncomfortable? Did he get frustrated with the automatic shades? Was he visited by the ghost? Lisbeth and Xavier have never discussed the ghost. She was too embarrassed to address it, though certainly he saw references to the ghost on their travel tattler reviews.
"Everything's fine."
Xavier's voice sounds staticky and far away. She's on the speakerphone in his car, or maybe he's already in the air.
"I have to fly home to tend to a business matter. I'm afraid it couldn't be helped, though God knows I tried."
A business matter? Doesn't he have people for this? He's been on Nantucket for less than 24 hours. "I'm so sorry to hear that, Xavier." If he hasn't actually boarded his plane, Lisbeth might be able to lure him back. "I had a beach trip planned for you, a journey up to Great Point. We prepared a picnic."
"Sorry to miss it," Xavier says. "I'd like to say I'll do it next time, but I'm not sure there will be a next time."
Lisbeth nearly drops the phone. What does he mean, he's not sure there'll be a next time? Did something go wrong? Did something happen? She wonders if maybe Richie rubbed him the wrong way. Impossible. Richie is an ace. Or if maybe he found out about Doug the dog, wouldn't he have said something?
"It's nothing to do with you or the hotel. Don't worry."
Xavier clears his throat.
"You've done an outstanding job with everything. I'm proud of you, Lisbeth."
Lisbeth is struck dumb. He got her name right. She would count this as a victory, but something in his tone sounds so final. By the time she opens her mouth to speak, to say, "Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I look forward to next year when we actually know what we're doing. Most of our staff is returning," she hears a beeping noise. Xavier has hung up. It was Edie who checked in the Marsh family back on June 6th, and because Alessandra has taken lunch, it's Edie who checks them out. Edie thinks back to the moment Kimber, Wanda, and Louis first walked in. Kimber with her peacock-dyed hair, Wanda and Louis in their little glasses, and then the surprise of Doug. If they'd checked in today instead of on day one when Edie was so desperate to win the $1,000 bonus, would she have been as accommodating? Would she have booked them for 11 weeks without a credit card? Would she have upgraded them to a suite and allowed a dog? It's a moot point now. Edie can say, and the whole staff would agree, that they're happy to have had the Marsh family among them for the summer. The hotel will feel incomplete with them gone. She presents Kimber with the final bill.
Your last night's stay is on us, and last night's room service as well. We're really going to miss you.
Kimber waves a hand in front of her face. Stop. You'll make me cry.
I want to thank you, Edie says, for mentioning me in the Travel Tattler review.
What are you talking about? Kimber says. I didn't write a Travel Tattler review.
You didn't? Edie says. I thought for sure.
Kimber glances over at Wanda, and Edie gasps.
Did Wanda write it?
Kimber grins.
No, it was me.
You're one of a kind, Edie Robbins. Richie comes down the hall with the luggage trolley.
Zeke is taking Doug out the side entrance.
He looks at Edie.
And my stuff is packed up as well.
Great, Edie says. My mom says you can move in anytime.
One of the other things that's changing with the Marsh's departure is that Richie is coming to live with Edie and Love until the hotel closes for the season. Kimber confessed to Edie that Richie had been living in his car before he moved into Suite 114. When Edie told her mother this, Love offered Richie their spare bedroom for a very reasonable rent. Lisbeth appears from the back office as Kimber scans the list of charges.
This all looks good.
She pays the balance in cash, then throws in an extra $1,000.
To split among the staff, she says.
Her eyes glass over with tears.
Getting away this summer with the kids was the best decision I've made in my life. Thank you.
She takes Richie's hand.
If we end up getting married, you're all invited.
Come back and see us again, Lisbeth says. She gives Kimber a hug and then, as they planned, Edie brings out two gifts from the back. Nancy Drew Mysteries number 46 through 48 for Wanda and the lobby chess set for Louis. Edie gives each of the children a tight squeeze. Louis squirms and Wanda starts to weep, saying,
I don't want to leave. What about Grace? She'll be lonely without me.
Kimber ushers Wanda to the door.
Let's go take a picture of Adam and Zeke, honey.
She gives Lisbeth and Edie a weary smile. It's going to be a long ride home.
Be safe, Edie says.
She waves as the Marsh family steps out of the lobby into the sun, then turns to Lisbeth.
This is the worst part of the job.
By far, Lisbeth says, running a finger under each eye.
You know I wanted to kill you when you told me you'd rented them a room without a functioning credit card,
and then that you'd upgraded them to a suite for 11 weeks,
and then that they had a pit bull.
But that was the right call in the end for so many reasons.
Because Wanda wrote an article about the ghost, Edie says, which increased occupancy.
More than doubled it.
And Louis entertained people with his chess, Edie says. So many people mentioned it in their Travel Tattler reviews.
And Richie was happy and had a place to stay, Lisbeth says. If he hadn't met Kimber, he might have quit, and I would have been stuck. He's such a team player. I haven't had to worry about billing. He's taken care of all the financials so that I could focus on the guests and the staff.
It all worked out the way it was supposed to, Edie says.
But you couldn't have predicted any of those circumstances.